This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll check in with public health experts about where Shasta and Butte counties are with a possible surge, and why staying at home is still critical, despite the fact that California has started flattening the curve. We'll also head up to the Upper Ridge and hear from a church that's been helping campfire survivors get essential goods like food, and how they've been affected by the pandemic. If you have questions or comments, you can leave them on our message line 433-9216 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Wednesday, April 15th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. State health officials identified nearly 1,000 more Californians infected with COVID-19 Tuesday, pushing the latest figure available to 23,338. The number of cases in California has jumped 47% over the past week, slowing slightly. Fatalities rose sharply between Monday and Tuesday, with 71 more deaths reported in the state. The number of victims stands at 758, more than double the total a week ago. The number of confirmed cases and deaths in the North State continues ticking upward. Public health authorities across the region have now confirmed 97 cases, a 36% increase over the 71 cases known about a week ago. The number of North State deaths remains at 7. Shasta and Sutter counties continue reporting the most cases, with 25 and 24, respectively. Butte County reported 16, Yuba County 15, Siskiyou 5, Glenn and Plumas County 4 each, Colusa 3, and Tehama 1. Both Lassen and Trinity counties continue reporting no cases. Drivers and business owners should see some money from insurance companies flowing their way over the next few months. State Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara Monday ordered insurance companies to send partial refunds or some form of premium credit for buyers of automobile insurance and workers' compensation insurance. With a stay-at-home order in place, many workers are idle and people are driving far fewer miles generally. That means insurers are paying fewer claims. Lara's order directs insurers to bring premiums back in line with overall risk and refund or offer a credit for the difference. The first batch of up to 3,000 locally made plastic face shields were delivered to Enloe Medical Center Tuesday, part of an effort enlisting people with access to 3D printers. The face shields are being produced by partnerships linking the hospital with faculty from CSU Chico and Idea Fab Labs, a Chico-based tech startup. The group modified a design made available by Georgia Tech and is churning out 1,500 a day, with some going to law enforcement and doctors and dentists' offices. Registered nurses calling attention to an alleged shortage of PPE held a brief job action at Dignity Health Mercy Medical Center Merced on Tuesday afternoon. Unionized nurses say efforts by management to ration PPE are raising health risks for everyone. Meanwhile, state Republican legislative leaders called on Newsom to give leading business owners an equal voice with employees in discussions on reopening the economy. Also in the legislature, a newly formed state Senate subcommittee set to review California's response to the coronavirus will have Republican State Senator Jim Nielsen as vice chair. The subcommittee's inaugural hearing is set for Thursday. Nielsen, who represents much of the North State, has been known to criticize state spending and Democratic priorities. He's also praised Governor Newsom's speed and leadership during the crisis. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. This week, California Governor Gavin Newsom said the curve is flattening in the state. And for the first time, he outlined a framework for reopening the economy, saying we were in a new phase of this pandemic. This was hopeful news, but it does not mean that we are out of the woods. And officials are saying now is no time to become complacent. And this is true for the entire North State, where officials are saying a surge is very much still possible, depending on how vigilant our communities are at following current stay-at-home orders and how orders eventually become lifted. At a Shasta County press conference Wednesday, Daniel Walker, supervising epidemiologist, laid out the scenarios for his county. And there were staggering different futures there, depending on whether lax rules were to be implemented in the near future. These would be things like having isolation be voluntary for only high-risk groups, allowing small gatherings to happen again, and possibly reopening some schools, versus keeping a stricter order, something closer to what we're currently experiencing now. Here's what he found.
With the strict stay at home, would kind of estimate that around 2% of the population would become infected and that we would never overwhelm our hospitals. And then whereas the lax stay at home order, it would estimate that around 43% of our population would become infected and that around June 16th is when we would then become overloaded.
Yes, 2 months from now. Again, that is if Shasta County had lax rules. He said currently our reality is somewhere between the two models, something he said is borne out by the number of people seeking care. He said if rules were eased, that would change quickly, and hospitals could see an increase at an exponential rate. As of now, though, Walker says current trends suggest the virus's progression in Shasta County is lagging the rest of the state and nation.
What we've seen is this much lower rate of hospitalizations. A lot fewer people will become infected over time. And so that's what we're hoping for. And that's what we're wanting to continue to do. And if you look at this map compared to California, it's projecting that our peak and our rise in cases and things like that will be later than the rest of California, because we have seen that increase of cases at a later than a lot of the urban areas who have been impacted in the beginning of this.
The map Walker was referring to is called COVID Act Now. It was put together by a group of volunteers working with epidemiologists and public health experts around the nation, and you can use it to find data on your county. The website is covidactnow.org. We'll also have it on our website. Again, this is one of many models, so to look into where we are in flattening the curve in our region's other most populous county, Butte, we decided to reach out to the county's public health officer, Dr. Andy Miller. He spoke with NSPR's Andre Bayek recently. The conversation started around testing and what the current testing capacity is for the county.
Testing has been a challenge for us from the beginning because our labs didn't have the equipment and reagents necessary. So we've relied upon the state lab and early on larger public health labs in other jurisdictions like Sacramento. We are able to test now in Butte County, and the capacity for testing will continue to expand, which is an important and, as the governor said, a prerequisite step before we can make many significant changes to the stay-at-home order and to social distancing recommendations.
Staying on testing, Butte County Public Health received a $250,000 grant from the North Valley Community Foundation to purchase lab equipment to test for COVID-19. Where does that equipment currently stand in its operation?
I believe all of that equipment has been received and is being installed and verified. And then we have to receive all of the reagent that's necessary. So we are working all of those fronts on the same time. So there is the last update I got was that we expect that to be up and running in the next couple of weeks. But like I mentioned, we're working a number of other avenues at the same time, as are our partners, to try to have other testing options. So both of our hospitals have equipment that can run testing and are expecting reagent anytime. I actually am working with the state testing task force as a representative to that group, and will be on calls later today, trying to understand how the distribution of reagents and testing supplies is going in the state.
How does more testing help broader public health issues when it relates to the virus?
So if we had, let's just say that we had access to all the testing we wanted, we could, especially for those symptomatic patients that are considered to be the most infectious, those people could be tested and asked to stay home until the results of those tests come in. And if the tests come back positive, we can do that work I was describing before, which is trying to understand those around them that might have been exposed and try to limit those people's activity out in the community while we wait to see if they develop symptoms. So that's the containment part of a disease outbreak, where we are, you know, literally working case by case, doing contact investigations and limiting the spread of the virus by decreasing the number of people that are infected by any one person.
Speaking to some other things the governor has mentioned, which is he doesn't expect large gatherings or sports events to return until we have herd immunity and a vaccine, would you be able to share some insight on what exactly herd immunity means?
When outbreaks happen, it's because a contagion like a virus comes into a population that is susceptible to that contagion. And so, for instance, when we had measles come into our community around a year ago, even though it's a very contagious virus, the most contagious that we know of, you didn't have hundreds and hundreds of cases, and you didn't have this level of concern because most people have antibodies or immunity to help them, to protect them from getting measles. And so that is herd immunity. That is that the virus cannot rapidly expand through a community because it hits roadblocks in most people that it comes up against, and they do not become symptomatic, and they are not amplifying the virus in their body and then not infecting many others around them. So that is herd immunity. It is the immunity of most people that leads to a virus kind of slowly petering out over time rather than expanding as it goes from susceptible person to that then infects more than one susceptible person who then go out and infect others, creating an exponential curve.
Are there any benchmarks we could look at to help us understand whether locally we've reached herd immunity?
Well, if we had, there are different types of testing. There is antibody testing, which is different from the testing that we use to make the acute diagnosis. Those tests are starting to become available. There's one of them that is FDA approved at this point that I know of. There are many of them that are allowed to market under an FDA emergency use authorization, but whose accuracy and really legitimacy is not yet proven. But let's say that we have good serologic or antibody tests, and we were able to test, you know, a representative sample of our people, then we could get an idea of how many people had been exposed, and that would help us with our models about how many people we expect would get infected and how many people would need hospitalization. So that's how we can try in the weeks and months and who knows, years to come, to try to figure out how many people have immunity and what our community numbers look like.
You mentioned a timeline there. To that point, we've been hearing that the next several weeks could be critical at managing and responding to the spread of the virus. Is that true locally as well, that the next several weeks here in Butte County are of critical importance?
So if you have a susceptible community, every several weeks that hasn't exploded become important. I think we've been in California and then in Butte County very successful at keeping the number of cases, at least the number of cases that have been identified, on kind of a steady state at this point. So hospitals are not overwhelmed. Case doubling rates are not happening very quickly or really at all. But I think we all, especially in areas that haven't been hard hit, like maybe some of the Bay Area places or, you know, in other countries where the virus was kind of left to burn freely through large sections of the population, I think we also likely have less immunity still. So that is the difficult balance between allowing or permitting, not really allowing, but having the virus move through our communities, but not in such a way that we are exposing those that are at most risk, and not in such a way that we are overwhelming our healthcare system. So the trade-off is between how much interaction we allow people to have and allow for spread versus how much we can clamp down on all of the activities that we are used to and the economy that we all need in order to be happy and healthy as well.
We're hearing from state officials that Californians as a whole have flattened the curve, but it sounds like there's still reasons to be concerned here locally in Butte County for people to remain vigilant. Is there any cause for concern that people could become less vigilant at heeding social distancing guidelines and hand washing and things like that?
Yeah, there is that concern. And that's that balance that we talk about is how can we find a reasonable middle ground between, you know, at one end, which would be extreme social isolation or social distancing, which really in the U.S. and in California, we've not implemented the way they needed to in other countries when they got to a worse space. But where do you land on that social distancing side versus where do you land on the how do you have a functioning society? And so that's really what the governor was speaking to when he had those six domains that he said, these are the things that we need to have some assurances and be working on in order to incrementally open back up. So yeah, there's concern. I think you want us to be concerned. I think you want your hospitals to be preparing and concerned, and you want public health to be concerned and watching and raising the red flag if we see trends that are worrisome.
Is there still concern for a possible surge in Butte County?
Absolutely.
And what could that look like and when?
Well, I mean, there are different models from different places with different assumptions. And so I'm not going to try to speak to specifics. I'm just going to say that, you know, when you still have a susceptible population, that is still a possibility. And I think that is why the governor is not going, you know, it's not all or nothing. It's not, hey, you know, it's stay at home and everybody stay in place, or everybody's loose to live the way they used to in the old normal. I think that's why he talks about a new normal, because I think things will have to get back to that old normal slowly and incrementally in order to limit the probability that we will have unacceptable surge in our state and in our county.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about this pandemic that you'd like to clarify or add?
As much as we are all tired, we still have a lot of work to do, and I'm thankful for so many. I'm thankful for my my public health colleagues who have been working just a lot for a long time, and I'm thankful for our healthcare partners who have made sacrifices and stepped up to the plate in so many ways, and then I'm just thankful for the people of Butte County who really have taken it seriously and made a difference. And hopefully we can continue to find that right balance where we're protecting people going forward.
That was Butte County Public Health Officer Dr. Andy Miller speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. You're listening to special coverage of the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. Stay tuned. More just ahead. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. This week, we've been looking into what this pandemic means to recovery after the 2018 Camp Fire. That disaster touched every aspect of life for those living in Paradise and surrounding communities like Concow, Yankee Hill, and Magalia. And now this crisis is too. To understand how the pandemic is affecting food security on the Upper Ridge, we spoke with Shel Morley from the Magalia Community Church. Morley recently spoke with NSPR's Christian Solis, who started by asking how many people the church was helping recover before the pandemic.
The recovery was doing pretty good, and we were down to 85 people a day. And then coronavirus hit, the lockdown hit, people started losing their jobs, and we're writing about 185 people a day.
And is the Magalia Church going to be able to continue to help those families at those numbers?
I sure hope so. Different things I've read online makes me think that we're not going to go back to the normal people think we are. Our biggest thing is, since we can't hold church, we're not getting donations. Our deposit today was $30. That's for tithes and offerings. Mm-hmm. You pay your bills on $30? I got $8,000 just in insurance I got to pay. Yeah. So, God has been providing miracle after miracle after miracle here. We got empty shelves, we pray, and food shows up. Well, now I got all these bills and no money coming in, so we're praying again.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your email, you had mentioned that the North Valley Community Foundation had donated money, and so that money was just designated for food, but you're having issues finding other things that you need?
Yes, exactly. The grants are earmarked for specific things, okay? Like the COVID-19 grant. That's only to give relief for people that need help with food, okay? I have a winter needs grant. That's only to go for certain things. We still have things that the church needs to spend money on. Like I said, insurance, that's something that the church has to pay for.
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about what kind of services that the church is offering to the community now during the coronavirus pandemic.
Well, we're not able to open up our tents. So this is just for drive-through food. So people come in their cars. Then our people come out with a clipboard to go over their order. Okay. What they need of the offerings we have for that day. Then our workers go in and fill that order. So there's nobody going in here and touching food or touching anything. We fill their order. We take it out. There's pallets next to where the cars park. We put the food on the pallets, and then they put that in their car.
And what new needs are arising in the community as a result of this? And what are some of the barriers that are in the way of the residents that's keeping them from addressing these needs?
Well, a lot of people have lost their jobs, let's face it. And their one expendable budget item is food. So they're not buying food. They're getting it here. And unless and until we go back to as close to normal as possible and people get back to work, this is going to continue on.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the supply chain of food coming in from the food banks that you mentioned was strained under this increased pressure across the state? Can you tell me a little bit more about how the church is handling that and working with those food banks?
We're ordering as much as we possibly can from the food banks. We have a credit limit, but we are always exceeding that credit limit because we have the needs. So we get as much as we can possibly get from them. If that doesn't work, then we have to go to places like Costco and Cash and Carry to get food that we need.
Now, it sounds like essentially the major problems you're facing is a lack of resources and too many people that need those resources. You know, if you could wave a magic wand, how would you address these problems?
I truly believe the food is out there someplace. It's just not readily accessible right now. So if I had to wave a magic wand, I would open the doors to the food banks, the food stores, and get what people need as far as food goes, you know. We distribute tomorrow USDA commodities. Those have all come pre-boxed, but it isn't as much as it normally is. I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. Normally there's more of a variety of things. So, you know, short of getting rid of this virus and people getting back to as close to normal as possible, I just think we're going to continue on this way, and we just have to roll with the punches and try to get food and necessary items to the people that need it. Mm-hmm. And that has been getting creative. We can't get it from the food banks? Okay. Let's get in the cars and trucks and go down to Costco and cash and carry and the different places and try to get the food that we need there.
That was Shel Morley with the Magalia Community Church speaking with NSPR's Christian Solis. And that is your program. Before we head out, I do have one message I'd like to share with you from a voice you're likely familiar with.
Hello, this is Mike Fishkin, host of Afternoon Classics. So sorry that you miss me, and I miss all of you too. But I certainly hope, in order for us to get back on our feet again, please practice all your social distancing and all. Although we are physically apart, we are all in this together to help overcome whatever obstacles possible. Thank you very much.
And don't forget, you can call our message line anytime with your comments. That number is 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. Tonight's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is special coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30, or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.